Good morning. My name is Dick Skelly, and I'm an alcoholic. At this stage of my sobriety, I hope I'm an alcoholic. As if I'm not, I've wasted 35 years of my life coming to these damn meetings. My home group is the East Marietta Group. It meets on Friday night at Holy Family Catholic Church. The church is also my parish. In fact, I was asked to make the initial approach to hold a meeting there some 33, 34 years ago. And as a parishioner, I went to the pastor and I told him, Father Mulroy, the Catholic population of Georgia is about 2%. The Catholic population of AA in Georgia is about 36%. You owe us some space. So I think it's a disease that may start in the baptismal font at the church. And I do want to excuse, I have notes. These are for your protection. In addition to being an alcoholic, I'm also a Celtic mystic. For those of you unfamiliar, a Celtic mystic is an Irish bullshitter. And we could be here till 3 or 4 o'clock this afternoon if it weren't for the notes. I was going to give my humility talk, but there aren't enough people here. Like most of you, I used alcohol in the beginning because it worked. It did what it was supposed to do. In my late teens and early 20s, alcohol made me comfortable talking with girls. I could conduct conversations and not feel out of place or nervous. And alcohol worked. It did the job. A little bit later on, in college and law school, I went to college and law school on scholarship, and I was going to school with people who were paying their own way. They were especially in law school, my classmates were the sons and daughters of bankers and doctors and judges. My father was a steel worker, and if it weren't for scholarship, I would not have been going to college and law school. And the law school at Seton Hall University, they were kind enough to put it right next to a tavern. How considerate could they be? And I'd go to that tavern after classes with my classmates, and they would be talking about their prep school lacrosse team. I didn't go to a prep school. I never played lacrosse. I went to a small parochial high school, and I played stickball in a playground. But after a couple of drinks, what the hell, I played lacrosse too. Alcohol worked for the longest time, and then it stopped working. It was in the mid-70s. I had been getting increasing pressure from my wife, who, by the way, is just 2.5 years in this program. She was getting dissatisfied with my drinking and was beginning to express this dissatisfaction. So I decided to get the heat off. I looked in the yellow pages, and I found there was a clubhouse called Rebus down on off of South Cobb Drive. So I went down there to a meeting and picked up some pamphlets and prove I had been there. Came home drunk that night, threw the pamphlets on the table in front of my wife, and insisted that the damn thing didn't work. And this was in January of 77. I didn't get sober until May. It's interesting, you know, we lawyers have our own unique blockages to sobriety. Among other things, alcoholism is a disease of consequences. If you're an alcoholic who keep drinking, consequences begin to fall on you. We lawyers make our living postponing, diminishing, eliminating consequences. That's our job. And as a result, we put off the consequences long enough and probably drink longer than we should have before we seek recovery. It did provide the start for me, however. That meeting at Rebus where I picked up the pamphlets was in January of 77. I did not get sober until May. Between January and May, there was a trial scheduled. I was doing criminal defense work, and I prepared for trial, as I always do, by putting myself on half rations of liquor for 2 weeks before the trial, and I went to court all prepared. Well, it turns out the district attorney's primary witness was a police officer who had been called up to active duty by his guard or reserve unit. And I went into ready for trial that morning only to find out that the DA was going to ask for a continuance. Well, I was furious. My first reaction was fury. My second was frustration, because I could not argue to that judge, "Your Honor, I've had myself on half rations of liquor for the last 2 weeks. Who do you think you are granting a continuance?" And after going through fury and frustration, my next reaction was terror, because they were putting this trial off for 2 or 3 months. Now, if you're going to put it off for a day or two until early next week, I could keep a lid on it. I had no idea what condition I would be in 3 months from now. And that's when the terror hit. I realized I could not control me. Well, since I already knew where it was, I decided I'd go back to Rebus. And you know those clubs where they love you till you can love yourself? Rebus didn't go for that shit. I walked in there and I looked around. I got it right away. In fact, just like, well, not quite like here. Rebus had it. This was the old green structure before they built the cinder block building they have now. The old claptrap house stood where the current paved parking lot is. And they had a clock in the back and a clock at the front, and they were about 6 minutes apart in timing. And one of the guys who was getting sober with me asked his sponsor, you know, "How come that is 6 minutes faster than this clock?" And he said, "Well, if they both had the same time, we'd only need one clock." And the guy I was with seemed perfectly satisfied with that explanation. But I got into this meeting. I was still debating whether I really belonged here. And this was the mid-70s, and I was confronted. He died a couple of years ago by a man named Speedy. And Speedy Moore, mid-70s, came over to me. He was resplendent in a lime green leisure suit with white patent leather shoes and a matching belt and a belt buckle you could serve a turkey on. And he came over to me and he said, "You want what we have?" Not right now. But I stayed sober anyhow. The groups I went to, they had a system where they assigned you a sponsor, a temporary sponsor. If you didn't have one, even if you didn't want one, you were assigned one. And I had this fella, he was, what's the word? He was inflicted on me. And his name was Jim. And Jim was not as smart as me. And I spent the first year of my sobriety explaining to Jim the true complexity of life. I remember I there a day or two, and I remember one of the first questions, "How many of these meetings I got to go to?" He said, "Oh, we'll talk about that." And a few days later, he came to me, he said, You know, we've been talking and we decided that a man of your obvious intelligence and extensive education, you need to go to 7 meetings a week. I said, that's every day. He said, see, you're getting better already. So I began working the steps. It was battered and scarred, and the auctioneer hardly thought it worthwhile to spend much time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bid for this fiddle? He said. Who'll start the bidding for me? $1, then. Who'll make it two? $2. Who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, and going and going, but no. From the back of the room, an older man stepped forward and picked up the bow, and wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening its loosened string, he played a melody pure and rich as caroling angels sing. The music finished, and the auctioneer, in a voice that was hushed and low, said, what am I bid for this fine violin? And he held it up with a bow. $1,000. Who make it two? $2,000. Who make it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, and going and gone, said he. The crowd stood and cheered, but some of them said, we just don't understand. What changed its worth? Quick came the reply, the touch of the master's hand. I came here, and my master, my God, began getting in touch with me through these steps. And in my case, they weren't 12 steps. For me, they were kind of like 12 missteps. And that first step, I remember admitting that I was powerless over alcohol, but I didn't think my life was unmanageable. I had had a streak of bad luck, but it wasn't unmanageable. After all, I had 4 DUI arrests, no convictions. That's manageable. What happened was I used to drive around with a half-empty, half-pint under my seat so that if I did get stopped, I'd grab the keys, exit the car with the keys in one hand, the pint in the other, polish off the pint in front of the cop. Later on, when I flunked the breathalyzer, it was impossible to tell whether it was the result of drinking I did before I stopped driving or after I stopped driving. See, I was insane. I wasn't stupid. By the way, don't try that anymore. There's a law in Georgia now that if you're tested, you're presumed to have been that way for several hours. It's called Dick's Law. Not really. But I took that second step, and I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I asked to be restored only to as much sanity as I could handle. And I had to come in. I came to believe in a power. I had been raised in a church and did all the stuff the church asked of me. But I was a functional agnostic. I'd never be an atheist. I always felt sorry for atheists because they have nothing to holler out in the middle of sex. And I took that third step and made a decision to turn my life over to the will of God. Now, you hear people talk about that third step, and you hear them regularly on, well, I turned it over, and then I took it back, but then I turned it over again, and then I took it back. And the operative phrase in the third step is not turn it over. The operative phrase is make a decision. And the decision in our case is, for the most part, to take the remaining steps. The guy I sponsored for a while, he's an airline pilot. And he told me once, he said, you know, on a flight from Atlanta to San Francisco, in terms of hairline computer accuracy, that plane is only on course about 2% of the time. The other 98% of the time, it's correcting. But they've set the course, as the third step asked us to do. to set the course. And having set the course, you know when you're on it or not. And if you're not, you can get back on it. That's the benefit of setting the course. And you may spend 98% of your time correcting, but having set the course, you know what to correct to. And I had a met sponsor of mine. I got sober in May. I guess I was wallowing around in the fellowship in the first three steps. And he told me he was going on vacation in July, and he wanted me to do my fourth step while he was gone, because when he got back, we were going to do my fifth step. And I said, fourth step? He said, yeah, you got a lot of anger and resentment. And I didn't think I had any anger and resentment. And in fact, it really pissed me off when he told me that. So I did that first searchless and fearful moral inventory. And when he came back, we did the fifth step. And that fifth step is really the point at which you belong. Previous to that, you're kind of walking around defensively. You got all this stuff inside, and you don't want anybody to know about it. And when you're walking around covering up defensively, you can't open yourself up to the fellowship or to the world at large, because you're protecting something. You take that fifth step. You haven't told everybody, but you've let it out of you, and you no longer have to protect it. Over the course of my sobriety, I guess I've heard a couple of dozen fifth steps. They're all the same damn thing. Everybody thinks their stuff is so unique. A couple of dozen I've heard over the last 35 years. I think I've heard everything except maybe cannibalism. You know? They're all the same. Yet we all think we're so unique and we want to protect it. I was, my work had, we do a lot of work in computer contract litigation. And I was up in Raleigh, North Carolina, speaking to systems engineers of a client of mine. And we spoke with a bunch of them through the day. And at night, I went to a meeting at the Camel 24 Club in Raleigh. And who was at that meeting but one of the engineers I had been speaking to in the morning. And he took me aside. He said, you know, my sponsor's away, and I was waiting to take a fifth step, and he's going to be a couple of months before he gets back. Can you hear my fifth step? I said, sure. You know, pick a spot tomorrow, privacy, and get your fourth step, and we'll be there. So around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he cut off work, and I went into his office. And he had done his fourth step on his computer. And typical engineer, kind of obsessive, he had cross-indexed everything. Want to see how many times I've been resentful? It was then that I realized that his computer, on which he had done his fourth step, was part of a local area network. And I told him he may already have taken his fifth step. In a bigger way than he had thought, you know. In fact, one of the things we were litigating was computer security. Oh, he heard his fifth step, and it was pretty much the same as everybody else's. And then that sixth step, you tell us we're entirely ready to have God remove the defects of character. And it says ready. We in the law have a phrase, ready, willing, and able. They are three different things. This one asks us to be ready. And the sixth step in the big book, it takes up only seven or eight sentences. And all it tells us to do is to look at the first five steps, see if we've done as good a job as we can. And if we have, you go on. I was a DCM for my home area a while back, and my alternate DCM is an engineer, you know, kind of obsessive. And we were down in Macon for the state assembly, and we had a meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning. He called me about 6:45. Now, at 6:45, I was willing to go to that 9 o'clock meeting, but I was not yet ready. I had not done the things necessary. And that sixth step, all it asked us to do, is to do what's necessary to be ready. And then that seventh step, it says, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Notice it does not say, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, and he did. Does not say that. I still have most of the shortcomings I came here with. The only difference is they don't run my life anymore. Used to be, if you told me you didn't like my necktie, that gave me the right to burn down your house with your wife and your kids in it. Yeah, I've developed a sense of proportion now. But even today, after 35 years, if some little old lady cuts me off on the expressway, I'll still speed up to get next to her and give her the finger. The only difference, after 34 years, I no longer find it necessary to follow her past my exit. We got to that eighth step. It tells us to write an inventory. Now, you don't have to write an inventory for you. You know the people you've harmed. You don't have to write that down. The reason you write it down is to share it with your sponsor or some other trusted person before you go fumbling out there to deal with earth people, which you are incapable of doing at this point in your sobriety. But you give it to your sponsor and go through it with him. There'll be some things he'll tell you that that's not, you didn't do any harm. It was, what you did was wrong, but it didn't hurt anybody. There's no amends to make for that one. It may be somebody on there who's should not be made amends to right now. You know, maybe they still have the knife in their back. You know, you may want to wait a while on that one. But you review it with him. And then the ninth step, you tell you to make direct amends. And he took me aside. I thought I was going to run around and apologize to everybody. He said, you're an attorney. What does amend mean? I said, it means to change. He's right. Change. You come home drunk one night and knock over your neighbor's mailbox. You don't owe him an apology. You owe him a mailbox. That's the amend. You make the amends. You want to throw in an apology, go ahead. But the amend is replacing the mailbox. That's your amend. And that 10th step tells us to continue to take a personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I used to read that as, if I was wrong, promptly admit it. That'll save a lot of admitting, by the way. Just like they tell us in the book, you know, contempt prior to investigation. Contempt prior to investigation will save you a lot of investigating time. But, you know, and it tells you also to do it promptly. You know, crow is best eaten while it's still warm. The older and colder it is, the harder it gets to swallow. So make it promptly. I had an occasion a couple of weeks ago. I'm semi-retired now. And I put my name on the public defender list. They like to have senior attorneys for more serious felony cases. I had a short trial. And my adversary was a very young, very intense assistant district attorney. He was one of these guys who knew that God put him in the DA's office so that he could eradicate all evil from the world. He took me aside after a short trial. He said, you know, ridiculing your adversary and getting the jury to laugh at him is not going to do much for your reputation. I said, wait a minute, that is my reputation. A little mini 10th step with him. And that 11th step, it tells us we saw through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. Now, I was raised in Catholic schools, and we had a lot of prayers. We had prayers for the president and prayers for the men in the service, and prayers for the Pope and prayers for the crops. You know, I grew up in New Jersey. We didn't have any crops, but a guy in a corner growing marijuana, but that was about it. But when he speaks in the 12 and 12 bill and dealing with the 11th step, tells us that even in times of grief and sorrow, when the hand of God seemed heavy or even unjust, new lessons in living were learned and new resources of courage uncovered. We'll touch on this a little bit later, but that's become crucial for me. In that 12th step, it tells us, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, we sought to carry the message. And the spiritual awakening, a lot of people look upon Bill's experience in Towns Hospital as the spiritual awakening, is not the one we're talking about in the 12th step. The 12th step talks about a spiritual awakening resulting from these steps. The one Bill had was before we had the steps. He may have inadvertently taken two or three of them, but we hadn't had these steps yet. In fact, the old timers refer to Bill's experience in Towns Hospital as Bill's hot flash. Bill's real spiritual awakening came in Akron months later. And when he looked back on when he was threatened with taking a drink, it tells us he was in the lobby of this hotel and he was going to go into a bar and have a drink. I think it was a gay bar because they said he heard the gay crowd inside. Akron, 1935, who knows? But when he sought help, he did not look back on that experience in Towns Hospital. When he was looking for help, he thought back on all those drunks he had been working with all those months since the prior November, and he knew he needed to find another drunk to talk to. And that was his real spiritual awakening. And it was a realization that I need them as much as they need me. He needed another drunk. And he found Dr. Bob, and we came on from there. Like, it always strikes me how fortunate we are. Suppose Bill's trip to Akron had been a financial success. He would have signed that deal with the rubber barons, made a bunch of money, gotten on the train and gone back to New York, and we'd all be screwed. Then also that 12th step tells us to carry the message. And people talk about, you know, doing their 12th step work, being on the 12th step phone list and getting phone calls at, you know, 11 or midnight or 1 in the morning. My calls used to come around supper time, and there were four kids in our house. I told you we were Catholic. And these kids would come at supper time, and supper time in a house with four kids can be kind of hectic. And if the call came, I'd talk to the guy, see if he seemed all right. If he was halfway all right, I'd try to meet him around 7:15, so that if it worked out well, we could take him right to an 8 o'clock meeting. And I'd make this arrangement up, and I'd come back and let my wife know what was happening. And she'd ask me things, well, before you go, can you help me get the kids ready for bed? I said, sure. You ever try and convince a 2- and a 4-year-old that just because they're putting their pajamas on now does not mean they have to go to bed right now? Come here, let Daddy help you with your pajamas. It's not bedtime. I know, put your pajamas on now and go to bed. You're going to make me go to bed. No, I'm not going to make you go to bed. Put your pajamas on now. Mommy, Daddy's going to, God damn it, put your pajamas on. And I'd be leaving the house, and a wife, you know, when do you think you'll be back? As soon as I give this son of a bitch some of my serenity. Yeah, so fortunately, there was a half hour between the time I left the house and the time I confronted this guy. But you carry the message that you can. And you do that with sponsorship. I sponsor the way I was sponsored. It's kind of like the way you parent, the way you were parented, you know. And the people I sponsored tend to have less than 6 months or more than 5 years. It seems somewhere around 6 months they get sensitive and they find another sponsor. There was a guy I worked with. He was doing fine sobriety-wise, but I told him he ought to get a job so he'd have, you know, something to do between meetings. And I'd see him, you know, get a job. No, I don't have a job. And after pestering him for a couple of months, I said, I'll get a job. I said, oh, where are you working? He told me he was working at Bed Bath & Beyond. And I asked him if he worked in the Beyond department. He fired me, got another sponsor. So you carry the message the way you can. And many of us with life out of time and battered and scarred within have sold ourselves cheap to the passing crowd, much like that old violin. A night in a tavern, a round of drinks, some jokes, and he travels on. He's going once, going twice, going and almost gone. But the power comes, and the foolish crowd can never quite understand the worth of a soul or the change that's wrought by the touch of the master's hand. I have a once I got sober, as I mentioned, I started doing a lot of work in computer law, and there was a cue to that that was only made possible by the program. And lawyers love to rely on precedent. Whatever was decided before is likely to be cited again. But in the area of computer law in the mid-70s, there was no precedent. And I had to learn from this program to make uncertainty your friend. Because I was out there giving advice and having to let people know, we're not really sure about this one. They haven't decided it before. And people would ask, you know, what happened was I got sober and I wound up taking a job with a company that gave seminars to doctors on how to run the business end of a medical practice. And the doctors at that time were the first of the really small businessmen to be getting into computer networks. And these were businesses that did not have internal employees of programmers or systems people to advise them on their way. And our group provided that advice on a contract basis. And we also told them that we would be with them through the acquisition process and help them with that, but they were doctors and they knew everything, so they did it on their own. And then I'd get a call a couple of months later, you know, can you get me out of this contract? I tried a couple of cases, and just learning what you have to learn to try a case. After trying a half a dozen or so of these, I looked around and I said, you know, I now know more about this than 99% of the attorneys in the country. I'm an expert. So we practiced in that area for a while. When I got sober, I'd start bumping into people in the program who had an array of difficulties. I remember one time I spent the morning in depositions with systems engineers trying to get them to speak English. And then the next morning, I'd be there with one of our brethren who had been 10 weeks sober, and something that happened 12 weeks ago was coming home to roost. So I go into court with my three-piece suit, this gray hair and this voice, and address the court. And yes, Your Honor, the defendant was running naked down Bell's Ferry Road with a fistful of Q-tips up his butt, insisting he was the Easter Bunny. But we do have an explanation, Your Honor. Sing Peter Cottontail for His Honor. But, you know, now in semi-retirement, I put my name on the public defender list, and occasionally I get these files and I read them, and I'm going, you're doing this just for me, aren't you, God? There's one guy, I got him out on probation, and I got a letter about 3 weeks ago that they're revoking his probation because he punched out his anger management counselor. So, it happens. But, you know, I found out with all the work you do, some things happen that are, that make it all worthwhile. And about 12, 13 years ago, over at 8111 in Sandy Springs, was a girl named Pat M. And she was living in a halfway house, and we'd come to the meetings on a van with half a dozen other women. And she took me aside once because she had gotten a letter from the district attorney's office in Fulton County. It turns out that Pat, at the end of her drinking and drugging, had become pregnant. And because of her drinking and drugging, she miscarried the baby. And because she was brought to the hospital by law enforcement, the incident made its way to the DA's office, and had written her a letter, and some hotshot in the DA's office decided he might try to prosecute her under Georgia's new fetal drug and fetal alcohol laws. He wrote her a letter telling her to come down for an interview. I saw the letter and told her immediately she was not going to go for that interview. And I wrote the DA a letter. I told him I had researched the law in other states and that they were going to have to prove, number one, she knew she was pregnant when she was taking the drugs. Number two, they might even have to prove that she knew the specific drug she was taking was capable of permeating the placenta and damaging the fetus. Well, he dropped the matter, never heard from him again. I guess he decided to go after some more defenseless woman. And it turns out that Pat, despite all her difficulties, had had a very good experience in college and a very high grade point average. And she had a graduation party for a month or two after that. And it turned out that because of her grades, she had applied to and had been accepted at Georgia's Medical College in Augusta, a college she would never be admitted to with a criminal record. And I didn't see her for a while. She went off to school. I'd see her on school breaks and get an occasional letter. And the last time I saw her to speak to at length was the day she had come back from medical school and was going on to Tennessee, to Kentucky, to do a residency in pediatrics. And she went off, and I'd still hear from her, or get a Christmas card or a letter here and there. And about 2 or 3 years ago, a girl from my home group, Susan, who is no longer with my home group, she lives in Savannah, where she is a neurologist. And I spoke with her while she was visiting back in Marietta. And it turns out that she and Pat were roommates at medical school. And she wrote to Pat and let her know she had seen me. And I got this letter back from her that kind of makes up for a lot of other things. She began her letter, as she always did when she wrote me, and said, "My dear blessed and profane hero, Dick, as I got a call from Susan last week after her return from Marietta, she called to say that she had spoken with you at length and reports that you are, thank God, still the same. When we last met at 8111 a few years back, I had just graduated and was in the process of moving to Kentucky for my residency. You probably thought I was either trying to strangle you with hugs or drown you with tears. You seemed a bit embarrassed, but told me to show my gratitude by using my skills occasionally without pay to help others in need. You told me that it's a rare blessing from God for people like us to be put in a position to do that. How can I ever forget how you did that for me? I pulled out your 3-page lawyer letter to the Atlanta authorities, and I read it again. It was at once strong and elegant and poetic. Your explanation to me, however, was less elegant and less poetic. As you explained it, I threatened them with more shit than they could shovel." It's nice to have a bilingual attorney. "Should I try to follow your example? There's no way we can pay back what we owe. The only repayment is to pass it on. One weekend a month, we take a volunteer van to Harlan and Verda and Everett's for well baby care, vaccinations, and general pediatrics. 12 years ago, I wrote a letter, and today a couple of hundred kids in Appalachia have a pediatrician." What the hell is that? That was not me. When I wrote that letter, I was an arrogant, wise-ass defense attorney trying to get one up on a prosecutor. But God took that and put it to use, and now a couple of hundred kids in Appalachia have a pediatrician. What is that? See, you just never know. You never know. Now, my journey here is not all that different from other people's journeys. When I came here, I had lost the home, the house, the kids, most of the money. And I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 2 years sober, my oldest boy, Brendan, needed open heart surgery. And we found out at that time that he was to be a retarded child. And I hurt, and I prayed, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 3 and 5 years sober, 2 more children were born to a reconstructed marriage. And I shared that joy, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. When I was 8 years sober, my youngest son, Kevin, was diagnosed with cancer. He had leukemia. And I hurt, and I prayed, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And at 13 years sober, he was declared cured of his cancer. And I shared that joy, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And at 20 years sober, my oldest boy, Brendan, died. And I hurt, and I prayed, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. In the years since then, my 2 daughters have gotten married, including the 1 daughter, the only one, and my only child, who remembers a drinking father. And I was there to give her away. And a little bit later, my only surviving son, Kevin, the one who had cancer at age 5, had gone to a camp for kids with cancer, and he went there year after year for many years. And in his teenage years, he met a girl who had come there for treatment for lymphoma. Then they met and dated and married. And I shared that joy. I didn't drink. I went to meetings. And here, a year and a half ago, my cancer-surviving son and his cancer-surviving wife presented us with our first grandchild. And I shared the joy, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And then when I was 30 years sober, alcoholism came to my home again. My wife of then 40 years suddenly shows up with the symptoms. And I guess it's an infectious disease. But she celebrated 1 year sober the same day our grandchild was born. And we shared the joy. We didn't drink. And we went to meetings. It's not easy, but it is just that simple. In fact, my wife and I, we've been married 44 years, but I still call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes, you know. But they tell us here our only job is honesty. Truth is God's domain. Truth is not our problem. We're only responsible for one truth, and I'm responsible for only one truth. And it's the truth with which I began my remarks to you this morning. And that truth is that my name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.